From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 551. In this episode, Scott talks with DigitalOcean product engineer Ihanye Ikechukwu about working in both design and development.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Ihanye Ikechukwu. He is a software engineer at DigitalOcean. How are you, sir?
Doing well, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm feeling pretty good. I'm happy to chat with you today. You posed a really interesting question on Twitter about this idea of should developers design? And it was funny when I saw that because I thought, I usually see people saying, should designers code?
Yeah. Like, I definitely wanted to think about that question because primarily because, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, should designers code? And that's like the running joke. But nobody really reverses the question and says, oh, should developers design? And, you know, it's funny because I have like a background in computer science and both computer science and graphic design. So I wanted to like really posit that question. And a lot of people are like, yes, but why aren't we pushing more developers to be more interested in design or improving their design skills?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that some people think, and we're just generalizing here, but I think some people think that designers have a design ability that somehow is innate, like you're mm-hmm. born knowing design and then you hone it through education while anybody can learn how to code. Like, I feel like I have no design ability, so I'm a lost cause.
Yeah. I guess that could be the case, but to be honest, like with anything, it's just a matter of practice, right? Like nobody came out of the womb with the innate ability to learn how to like program, right? And even with me, like I'm not really that good of an artist, but even doing design education, even from like before I started doing design, just looking at what like I was designing in terms of applications or user interfaces and then what I can produce afterwards, there was a dramatic difference in like the quality and all the theoretical concepts I learned from it because you learn the fundamentals that help you build better products and design better products.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we say design, just like saying, you know, software or engineering, it's one of those words that can explode into a million different words.
Mm-hmm.
Design, I think if it's just like the innate ability to make something pretty, like, but what are the kind of the components of design when you think about it in the context of making software?
In the context of making software, I think about design being not only like a lot of people may think of it only as aesthetics and like, you know, making things look pretty, but it's mm-hmm. also centered around, you know, the user. And in building products, you want to build delightful user experiences for your customers or your end users. Mm-hmm. And that being whether it is like the flow of the application, how it performs, or to more accessible design patterns like A11Y or accessibility is very important as well whenever you're also being like building out products.
Right. So if you think about design in the context of like painting or drawing, you know, they teach us about color and shape and form and they use mm-hmm. terms like harmony.
Yep.
But when you start thinking about user interface design, it's more about flow through time. How does someone use this as they move from screen to screen to screen?
Yep. Affordances and all that. A good book to like read to get a good sense of design and even design terminology is a design of everyday things. And it is really good at teaching like core concepts of like design, and even human centered design from a physical product standpoint, but it can also be revamped or applied to digital products as well. I feel,
you know, that's a really great point, right? The Design of Everyday Things is a classic book, by Donald Norman. And one of the great examples in that book is the idea of where they push, you know, when you're opening a door.
I hate that so much.
Talk to me about that.
Confused.
Tell us about the door.
With the door, you know, whenever you see a door and you think you see it as like a handle, but then
a bar that goes across it all the way.
And you think you're like, oh, you're supposed to like push or whatever, but then you end up like, you know, you end up pushing it, it doesn't open, you end up having to pull it. Or even the same way, if you have a door that has a natural handle, like a curved handle, you may think like, oh, okay, let me pull and open this door. But it's like, oh no, just kidding. You have to actually push it. And it's like those things that are, you may like, you know, you may not think that it's like user hostile, but you know, your brain has a certain context of like the way to interact with these products, or not products, or these like, physical things. And you just get confused by it, right? And it's like, you know, and it's just frustrating. And a lot of times, you know, it's frustrating in the sense that you can notice when something's bad, but you know, something is good design whenever it goes unnoticed, right? A lot of things that make your life easy to use are just dead simple to use. You don't ever really reflect on it. It's just like there and in the background. So, yeah.
Right. I think that there's a great example in the design of everyday things where they talk about the difference between a product that satisfies the customer. Like they just feel good about the product, while another one frustrates them, but they can't express why they're frustrated. They just know that they are.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really difficult when you're trying to design software, because now that software seems really, really easy and accessible, people who are not programmers or not designers will try to tell you how they want it. No, put the button over here.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not the feedback that I'm looking for from a customer. I don't want them to tell me where to put the button. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you want them to be able to give you in-depth feedback, like saying, so I know in critique in design school, whenever we're doing critique, my professor banned the words, I like this or I don't like this. He wants to say, I think this is successful because X, Y, and Z.
Right.
But on the other hand, like, or I think this falls short, is not successful because of X, Y, and Z. And when it comes to giving feedback, that kind of feedback is important when building products. You're like, oh, I think this is really confusing for the user because, you're forcing them to memorize too many things and like between the different screens, and it may not be the most optimal experience for them.
They talk about concept count.
Exactly. And even whenever, like, thinking about it, there was another, like, application I used to work on, or, like, a project at my previous job. I remember a prime example was, I used to go to this page, and we wanted to, like, prompt them to sign up. But then somebody, like, after they would close out the modal that says, like, hey, register for an account, they, like, somebody made the choice of saying, like, hey, 10 to 15 seconds later, have that modal reappear again. And I'm just like, that's user hostile because it's nagging. That's not successful because it nags the user. It obscures them from taking in the content. And that is how you drive users away from your website and your product. They're not going to want to go to your product if they know it's just going to be nagging them to sign up if they don't want to sign up.
You know, one thing I think that's interesting when developers start thinking about design is the developer-minded person, we start looking for rules, right? We love rules. Remember, we used to say people don't scroll. And then, of course, we solved that problem by putting scroll wheels on every mouse, right? So now the people don't scroll, put everything above the fold rule doesn't necessarily apply, right?
Yeah.
And then we made the three-click rule where it's like, you know, every page has to be three clicks away from any other page. And we would just we tell each other these rules, but we have no proof that this is a rule.
Yep, or no stats to back it up, you know.
I saw this really interesting article at UX Booth that talked about how people insist on using click counting to decide if something is a good design or not. And he had this great analogy. I'm wondering what you think about this. He says we shouldn't be using click counting. We should think about it in terms of cycling. If you're riding your bike and you're in a good gear and you're going up a hill, you're doing a difficult thing, maybe you have to pedal faster, but each pedal turn takes less effort. So I'm thinking about going through processes online or on my app that might involve lots of swiping and moving. But if it's intuitive, those turns of the pedal don't really hurt. Well, if it's like I'm staring at it, trying to figure out what to push or what to swipe or which way to swipe, it does hurt. So I like that idea that we should maybe stop counting so much and start thinking about how it feels.
Yeah, I think that's very important to, I like that quote, to be honest, because once again, you know, it ties back to what I said earlier, right? Bad design, you get really frustrated with it, but if something's just natural. Like, I know something that was kind of weak, or foreign to me in a sense was, whenever I had friends that had an iPhone or whatever came out, just seeing all these applications. I think one is called, is like Clear. It was like a to-do app or something, but it had a lot of it. Like its UX was primarily focused around these gestures and to add things, or even an inbox by Google or other mailbox apps. Like, oh, swipe left to like archive it, or swipe right to like, you know, send it to the trash or mark as done and everything like that. But I think it's just, it feels easier because especially I think I like that because rather than memorizing clicks or if it just flows naturally, users will get used to like getting the groove of things, right? Like just like have the effort of cycling. It seems like easy and straightforward and like not that painful or stressful on your muscles. Like just like memorizing how to use like an interface through muscle memory and everything like that through gestures, I think sticks more than clicking just because with clicking it's just a very I don't know, it seems very binary, right? Tap down, tap up. Whereas with gestures, you have like movement and like just like whenever it comes to writing and like I don't know, I don't even speak any of the like Eastern languages, but like a lot of my friends would, I'd see them studying for Chinese exams and what they would be doing, they'd just be using their fingers to draw characters in the air and associating those finger movements with each character. So I think there's something inherent to that movement that allows you to memorize how to use things better, at least in terms of, and like, I'm just thinking from a mobile perspective primarily.
Right. The word for that is kinesthetic learning. It's the idea that it's tactile learning. So it's where by moving your body, you're basically remembering it better. This is the thing that people do when they take notes, but they never read the notes. Have you ever had that situation?
Yeah,
it's the moving of your body that helps you remember it. But that application that you bring up, it was called Clear or Clear Tasks. It's from Real Mac Software. That was one of the first to-do apps that was like swipe here, swipe left. It was before Tinder and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Tinder's a good example of this.
Yeah, it takes it takes something that would ordinarily be difficult and makes it intuitive. But at the same time, if everyone starts doing it, then it becomes a chore if they don't do it consistently. I'll give you an example. I've got the app Inbox for my Gmail. And I've got Outlook for my work mail on my iPhone. Okay. Well, on one of them, swipe left does archive. On the other one, swipe right does archive.
Oh, wow. Oh, no. That's like confusing.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, and it's hard, right? Because there's no set patterns on it. But, you know, it's like people go against the norms. And that's why I guess having standards is like kind of important in a sense.
You know, it is extremely important.
Apple has their like, human interface guidelines, Google's like evolved
material design.
Yeah, material designs. Those concepts have been like the main guiding principle around their applications. And
Do you think, though, that these guidelines, I mean, doesn't it feel like we innovate and we confuse the user and then we standardize and then we standardize for a bit and then we go and confuse them again by trying some new concept like 3D touch is really confusing me because I never know how hard to push, you know, to get the thing to work.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good point. I think it can be kind of confusing to the user, especially if not everybody uses like 3D touch, right? Like, like, oh, I wonder if this has like 3D touch support. And you like try to do it and you're like, oh, wait, it doesn't, you know? It's kind of disappointing. But, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to speak on that, to be honest.
Well, where do you think, if you're, you know, right now, you live in a world where you have you're a professional developer, but you also have a background in design. They always joke about the unicorn out there, right? The developer who can design or the designer who can develop. Does that mean that if you can speak both languages, that you can be the bridge between the developers and the designer?
You know, I actually describe myself as the bridge between developers and designers because a lot of times things get lost in the middle, like in terms of communication. And, you know, I've seen situations where designers build out these really ambitious user interfaces and like they may like, you know, they may have a visual design background and not a product design background. And so it may look really amazing and be very ambitious. But then like, you know, developers are like, what the heck? We can't do this. Or even if we did, it's not worth like the effort because it's like really complicated. So it's like, and like, but they're not really communicating that well to the designer. And then the designer's like, oh, wait, this isn't like why doesn't this look exactly like the mock? And like, yeah, it's just like,
well, and what I think happens though is that when you have those back and forths, it makes developers and project managers feel like there's friction now. And it's like, well, you're just slowing us down.
Yeah.
And it seems like the first one that gets kicked out is the designer.
Yeah, I definitely. And I don't know. I think it's because, that's a good point in the sense that, I don't know, probably because with engineers, I guess, supply and demand, like, they're very high in demand, even though there's a huge demand for designers as well.
But doesn't it feel like we know that we need the developer because they're the one that pushes deploy.
Yeah.
So ultimately, like, the designer we don't care about because we've seen a lot of really poorly designed, websites out there. It just seems like, and it also seems like there's design culture, right? Like, it's clear that Apple products seem to, as a general rule, you know, value design maybe more than Google products because it's in their DNA.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's also in the last 6 years, like maybe even like longer than that, but I guess 6 years is just how long I've been like the industry since I got to college. Mm-hmm. Design really didn't come to prominence until like, I guess probably the last 6 years or so, maybe even 2008, at least digital product design, because we can all remember like, you know, how websites from back in the late 2000s look like and how they like interacted with. But really the game started changing, I think, with the release of the iPhone and even like these like touchscreen smartphones. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, it changed the nature of how we interact with products in general.
Well, it introduced a personal relationship with a thing. Like right now, I don't really feel a personal relationship with websites.
Yeah.
But somehow when I'm sitting there with just me and my little phone, it's my brain, it's my portable pocket supercomputer. Yep. And I really care if you move my cheese, like, man, who moved my cheese? Like, where, why does this behave like this? Then I care more viscerally than as opposed to a website.
Exactly.
Where I just visit another site.
Because also, yeah, definitely. And that makes really good sense. And it's just interesting to see how, the mobile, like, you know, with the introduction of mobile, these UX patterns, or there are new UX patterns invented, like rather than pressing like, you know, a button to refresh, you have like pull down to refresh rather than having, even at least on Android devices, typing in on a keyboard. You now can have like swiping for input and everything like that as well. So it just like really changed the nature of the game that and I'm only like 24, so I don't even know how like much it changed, but it's changed a lot from since when I was a little kid to now.
Well, I can tell, as someone who's almost double that age, I can tell you that design elements will come up, like the hamburger menu.
Yeah.
And someone will say, oh, look at that. There's a hamburger menu. And then like, that's the thing. That's the hammer that we all needed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we were waiting for a tool and someone invented the hamburger menu and now everything looks like a nail. And we're hammering in screws and rivets and all kinds of things that don't need to be hammered because we just got a new tool. And then, of course, another tool will come out and that might be 3D touch or swiping or whatever.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely.
Yeah. So where do you think that design is going to converge? Are we going to see that that websites and mobile apps are going to use the same design language?
You know, I'm not sure. Where is design going to converge? Website and mobile apps.
Like we've seen responsive apps, right? You've done responsive apps.
Mobile will always be ahead of web, to be honest. I feel like.
Really? Yeah. Why is that? I'm surprised that you say that because I feel that the web kind of leads in design.
Depends, right? Because I've tried to design a website, like a website that's like, you know, or like even a web app that's mobile first, and it's doable, but at the same time, like, goes back to these, like, gestures and these complex user interactions. It's not as easy to create those in the browser, like, or at least, you know, out of the box as it is to do in a native mobile application. But you know, it may be getting better in the future. Like, you know, you have framework or like technologies like React Native, like, you know, whether, even though it's like not exactly the same, but like you're still able to use the same framework or library that you're using to build your web apps to build your mobile applications as well.
That is a really interesting point. I've talking to people, and a lot of people feel that React Native is kind of going to sneak up on the internet. Like people who know, they know. They know React Native is great, but other people will say, React? Gosh, what's that about? And people are saying that React and catalogs of React parts are going to become extremely popular very, very soon.
Yeah. And like, to be honest, you can find a React component for like pretty much anything that you need nowadays, you know, and it's just amazing to see how in just a couple years, React has like blown up in terms of popularity. But I think design and development are also going to converge, because something we haven't really talked about is like, for example, you got augmented reality like Pokemon Go, and even virtual reality as well. Like with VR being a whole nother, like, you know, the future, there's going to be a really good, like a really huge convergence, because, you know, you need to have your 3D modeling, and like VR is going to change how it's going to do what the like smartphones did back in like 2008 or whenever the iPhone was released. It's going to change the nature of UX again.
That is interesting that you say that, because actually for folks that are listening and maybe listened last month, we had Scott Anderson, who is a virtual reality and augmented reality game designer. And people are really still discovering what's even possible. Just like if you remember when the iPhone first came out, people said it would be a lousy platform for mobile games.
Yeah.
Because no one had figured out how to move their fingers right. So people said, oh, will I be able to play Call of Duty on my iPhone?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, no, of course not, because how would you have your fingers? And we were struggling. We remember how we used to put like Super Nintendo fake virtual buttons on the screen.
Yep.
And they like, okay, well, maybe it'll work like this. And then they found their way to a metaphor that worked. The people, I guess, in the VR and AR world are poking at different interfaces, and we don't know yet what it's going to look like, but you're saying if they get it right, it's going to change everything.
Yeah. And I think it's like once VR or virtual reality becomes more accessible, then we'll start seeing more and more people getting into it. You know, I don't know. It's just hard for me to say without it being so mainstream, because I've only,
well, certainly it has to be less than $3,000.
Yeah. Right? I don't even have anything. I don't have a virtual reality headset.
Neither do I.
I've dabbled with it like at, tech events and all that, but you know, I don't have really the pockets deep enough.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think that for a lot of people, when the iPhone or the iPad first came out and it was expensive, people dabbled with these devices and they said, all right, well, that's cute, but I've got my flip phone or whatever. And then I know that I tried an Oculus a couple of years ago, and I thought to myself, all right, that's cool, but I don't really have the money and I don't want to spend the money on that. But one of these days it's going to be the new thing. It'll be $300 and it'll be at Best Buy, and I'll pick it up and it'll be amazing. But we're not going to see how hard the designers and developers worked to make that happen.
Yeah. And actually, I guess like since we're on topic, you work at Microsoft, y'all demoed a really cool piece of technology, like the HoloLens. That was pretty darn cool. Like,
yeah, it is. Yeah. It's $3,000 though. Right?
Yeah. Money I don't have again, but
no, exactly. But I hear what you're saying. Like, that's an example where designers and developers are on the edge of an idea, and they're poking at that edge of the envelope to see if they can break it, or what the right, metaphor is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of apps are you working on primarily? Are you working on mobile apps or web apps?
No, web. Most all web. Mm-hmm. We don't really have that many like mobile apps at DEO, to be honest.
But don't you make those mobile first or responsive, so they can at least load on a phone's website?
Yeah.
Or web browser?
Yeah, we do. To be honest, like, I don't think we have a lot of mobile visitors, but all of our apps do scale down to a mobile device, I believe. Mm-hmm. At least the product I work on, I know that it does.
Is that because you insisted, or is that why did it?
I don't know. I inherited it, and luckily it worked on mobile. So now there have been situations where we are adding new features and we had like, okay, or we've seen other parts of the application that aren't mobile first, and we're like, oh, okay, well, or not even aren't responsive. Sorry. And we're like, okay, well, we have to make this responsive. So we go like, you know, just have a brainstorming session with our designer, and she lets us know, or she whips up something really quickly, and yeah, we build it out.
How often does your work, I was going to say kind of butt up against hers, but if she, there's that bright line between she is the designer, you are the developer. Does she give you designs and then you just simply have to take them? Or because you can bridge that gap, do you maybe collaborate a little bit more?
We collaborate a lot. I don't even know, like, you know, we do, you pair programming, right?
Oh, interesting. Do you have pair programming between the developer and the designer?
Yeah, because a lot of times, like when after is we're done implementing her designs or something, if there comes around a feedback, like I think the rule of thumb that we settled on was if it goes back and forth like more than 3 or 4 times in terms of feedback rounds, then we should just take like schedule a meeting and pair together on implementing feedback in real time, because otherwise it's not going to be the best use of time, right? Because it's going to be asynchronous, but rather like asynchronous isn't the best for everything. It just like is good to pair up and be like, all right, let's fix this out, and that way since we're working together, she knows that it's good to go and I don't even have to wait for a review. I can just ship it after we're done.
Mm-hmm. Are you as a developer enabled to make design decisions or changes if you think that something shipped with the wrong design, or do you take it back to the designer and then iterate?
To be honest, like I don't really tweak designs, but like if I see something that makes me feel uneasy, I know I will like ask our designer about it, like, hey, what do you think about this? I don't know, it doesn't feel right to me, but then like, you know, she'll ask me why and I'll give my rationale. I don't think it's like doesn't work well for these reasons. And most of the time we'll think through together. She's like, what do you think we should do? She's like, how about what if we did this? And you know, we'll talk it out. And sometimes it'll be like, okay, nah, maybe this is like the most optimal way. But then sometimes like we're both like, oh yeah, I think like we like this way better. And we like continue on.
What do you think that someone who's listening, who is a developer on the way to work, should do in order to become a better designer? Because they may have long ago decided that they're just never going to be a great designer.
Yeah.
What should they do?
I think probably to be a better designer, I think everybody has the ability to at least like be a designer. You may not be building like the next Apple app of the year, but I think everybody can at least develop taste to tell like whether something is good or something is like bad.
Interesting. The way that you phrase that, like, I don't think you meant it to be funny, but I was like, well, you all could at least become somewhat, you know, what's the word? Literate.
Literate. Yeah. No, for real though. Like, I don't know. There's always a running joke, right? Like, whenever an engineer develops an interface, they just add a new button for every single new feature that they want. You know?
It's absolutely right. Because we all joke about the developer who tried to design an app, and we look at those apps and they are full of text boxes and bad colors
and buttons and like, for everything rather than trying to simplify it and group the like actions together. But yeah, I think like really try to develop taste for those working on web or even mobile. It's really important to understand like something like typography,
accessibility, kerning.
Kerning, tracking, letting, all that good stuff. Accessibility. And I think another good book to read outside of Design of Everyday Things is called Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug, I think is his name. That's a really good book to read, especially for those on the web. That's a really good book to read to just like get a taste of UX. And
right. I guess Don't Make Me Think is about this idea of a common sense approach to usability so that the users can just do their job. And that gets back to the beginning of the conversation where we were talking about that friction. Right. The analogy I used about the bicycle, right?
Yeah.
Make it easy. Don't make them have to jump through any hoops. Just they want to get their jobs done.
Yeah, exactly.
That's actually a very short book, in fact.
It really is.
It's a very easy read. It's maybe a couple hundred pages.
Yeah, I like read it in a couple of days. It was pretty straightforward. And there's lots of good like illustrations as well to illustrate the concepts.
Mm-hmm. So Don't Make Me Think is one. We said The Design of Everyday Things.
Yep.
Is another one.
And grid systems, like actually.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, actually, to be honest, like whenever I redesigned my website, I had been reading a lot on grid systems recently. There's a book, on grid systems by this Swedish or German. It's really good. It's just called Grid Systems in like Graphic Design or something.
Right. Yeah. That's by Josef Müller-Brockmann.
Thank you. Yeah. Him. Yeah. And that's a really good book to read. And thinking grids, like once you start learning about grids, you'll be able to like the way I think about user interface, I try to break it down and see if there's an underlying grid with it. And, you know, frameworks like on the web, like, you know, Bootstrap, it became popular just because it made it easy to build out these like UIs. But even though they may all look the same, but still it has a concept of a grid underneath it. And the grid is like, will do wonders for designing, like just being able to mock something out and break it up into a grid to make sure all your elements are aligned together and just like, you know, everything's uniform. Like it goes a long way. It may seem like minor nitpicky details, but it actually is very important.
That's actually funny that you bring up something like that, because here we are in 2016. Talking about mobile design on pocket supercomputers, and you mentioned the grid system, and I started thinking about CSS grids and grid systems and, you know, Bootstrap and things you can download. But the book that you referenced, which is about grids in design, grid systems and graphic design, is by a person who was born in 1914. Muller Brockman has been dead for 20 years. But that kind of classic design was standards, grid systems in the 40s and 50s apply even now. On the web.
And that's why it's important. That's why I majored in graphic design, right? Because even though it may be a whole different medium, the concepts, the core concepts are still what makes somebody a better designer and allows them to develop better taste as well. So it really just like the fundamentals, it may seem like, oh, why would I learn about grids? Like, what is this? Like, I'm not in geometry class, but no, really, it like will help your design sense a lot. And most people I know, even a lot of our designers work with like grids, even thinking about wireframing, right? Like it's like a very like broken down version or simplified version of laying things out into a grid. So
actually I'll end on reminding you of another great book called Thinking with Type.
I mean, that book's kind of dry, so I didn't want to like
do you have a better typography book? Because
no,
I feel like
I think that's the best one out there.
Isn't that awful? It just feels like one of the...
No, never mind. I'm thinking of elements of typographic style. Thinking with Type's a good one. My bad.
Okay. Okay. The elements of typographic style is a little older book. But the idea that, you know, like understanding fonts, understanding how white space should be used, you know, it's amazing how you'll show up on a website and it'll just have a white background and a gorgeous font, but somehow you'll just feel good about it. Like if you think about medium.com, it almost has no design at all. But we know it's awesome.
It just works. Yeah. It's like, works out simple. Like, I think a lot of things nowadays are over engineered or just over designed, but I'm glad with like brutalism or even just this like return back to simplicity in a sense and typography as a UI, like as a UX, like let the content and the type define the hierarchy in terms of, like your websites or applications, but it's interesting.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
No problem. Appreciate it.
And you can check out Ihanye on his own podcast called twoblacknerds.com. So be sure to check that out. And we have been collecting links and mentioning books. And I promise I will put all of those links and books in the show notes. So very cool. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. No, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.